KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmers market every Wednesday. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland. Online at peoples.coop.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector@kboo.org.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, city council sessions start with citizen communications.
Multnomah Dental Society's annual free children's health fair is here.
And on international news, China and Israel both condemned by the UN.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 8th, 2019. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Michelle Coppola reporting. The Democratic National Committee has announced that they will not allow Fox News to broadcast any of its 2020 presidential primary debates. The DNC cited a recent report detailing the close relationship between the Trump administration and the conservative cable network. A statement from DNC Chairman Tom Perez said, quote, "Recent reporting in The New Yorker on the inappropriate relationship between President Trump, his administration, and Fox News has led me to conclude that the network is not in a position to host a fair and neutral debate for our candidates. Therefore, Fox News will not serve as a media partner for the 2020 Democratic primary debates." The decision was spurred after an article by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker detailed the close relationship between Trump and the network. The article goes as far as to call Fox News Trump's personal press organization and, quote, propaganda. Party committees expressing frustration over the news coverage by denying networks debates is not a new occurrence. In 2015, the Republican National Committee announced they were prohibiting NBC News from hosting any future debates due to using, quote, inaccurate or downright offensive questions during a primary debate.
While conventional antidepressants can take two or more weeks to be fully effective, Spravato, a new antidepressant nasal spray approved by the FDA yesterday, takes only 24 hours. Because the drug, according to a warning label, may cause suicidal thoughts and dissociation, patients must be monitored for at least 2 hours every time they take Spravato. Just a single treatment of the drug can cost up to $885. In related pharmaceutical news, the mother of Ty Murray Irving has sued Portland State University for $25 million. Murray, a 25-year-old PSU student, died on March 12th of 2016 after taking Ambien, prescribed by PSU Student Health Services. The suit claims that the Student Health Services was negligent in not adequately investigating Irving's health history or warning him of the dangers of Ambien.
A new study has been released which shows that, unsurprisingly, the measles vaccine does not cause autism. Research linking the two was disproved and fully retracted in 2010. However, the measles epidemic in the Pacific Northwest has continued to spread to 11 states. The study released yesterday is an attempt to finally put to rest the misconceptions surrounding vaccines and autism. Scientists in Copenhagen examined data from 500,000 Danish children born between 1999 and 2010. They determined that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine commonly given to children is 97% effective in keeping children healthy and does not cause autism. Meanwhile, the LA Times reported that in January and February of this year alone, 206 individual cases of measles have been confirmed. That's more than the number of all cases in the year 2017 combined.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Both legislative chambers are passing South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem's Pipeline Action Response funds in one day. The bills were introduced on Monday. Supporters say swift action is about public safety. Critics point to a lack of transparency from her administration. Lee Strubinger reports.
During the last full week of session, the Republican-controlled State House has passed the governor's legislation. One bill sets up a fund that helps the state and county recover costs incurred for responding to pipeline demonstrations. The other allows the state, county, or third party to target wealthy individuals who allegedly fund riot boosting, as well as subjects a defendant to three times the cost of damages they may cause. Governor Noem says she's had conversations with legislators throughout the session about potential fallout from Keystone XL pipeline construction. Noem says her administration has crafted these two bills in the 2 months she's been governor.
What we wanted to make sure is that we brought legislation that was ready, that was right, that did what we wanted it to do, that was well thought out, and was responsible.
Critics are concerned how quickly these bills have moved through the legislative process. Democratic State Senator Troy Heinert says there were zero discussions with tribes prior to these bills dropping.
It's just put in our laps, and it's put in the laps of tribal law enforcement officers, too, because they don't know what their role is in this. And there could have been that conversation.
The ACLU of South Dakota says it's, quote, currently weighing all options to ensure the First Amendment rights of South Dakotans are upheld.
That was Lee Strubinger. Legal scholar and Native women's advocate Sarah Deer urged U.S. lawmakers to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act during a hearing in a House committee Thursday. Deer says VAWA 2013 had some successes in addressing violence against Native women, but says there's more work to do, such as expanding protections for children.
The Attorney General's Advisory Committee on American Indian and Alaska Native Children found that American Indian and Alaska Native children suffer exposure to violence at rates higher than any other race in the United States. Native children experience post-traumatic stress disorder at the same rates as veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and triple the rate of the general population. At this time, non-Native people who perpetrate crimes, including sexual assault and murder against Native children, cannot be prosecuted by the tribal government, and this injustice must be rectified.
Another need for tribal communities, Deer says, is expansions to address violence against tribal officers when handling domestic violence calls. VAWA expired last month. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members held a press conference Thursday to introduce the bipartisan Violence Against Women Act 2019. Representatives from Alaska Native organizations and tribes discussed governance at the first Tribal Affairs Committee hearing Thursday in the Alaska Legislature. The First Alaskans Institute, Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and Tlingit and Haida tribes gave an overview of Alaska Native history, tribal sovereignty, and the need for government-to-government relationships. The special committee is the first of its kind devoted to tribal issues. Congresswoman Deb Haaland became the first Native American woman to preside over the U.S. House. She sat in the speaker's chair Thursday during debate over voting access and campaign finance. Social media buzz included a tweet from Native American Congresswoman Sharice Davids with a picture of Davids watching Haaland on television with the hashtag Representation Matters. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support by BNSF Railway, moving our economy for over 165 years. Our vision is to operate injury and accident-free with safety programs, training, and technology. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations. For Native Americans affected by domestic violence, the Strong Hearts Native Helpline offers peer-to-peer support and resources. It's safe, confidential, and toll-free at 844-7-NATIVE. Program support by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. You'll want to stay tuned after this newscast for our special International Women's Day programming. At 5:30, it's What's Up With Your Down There? How Not to Clean Your Vagina with Miriam Rosenberg. At 6 o'clock, it's Asia Decoto, Tribes and Treaty Rights in the Columbia River Basin. Then at 6:30, KBOO's Emily Gresham Beamer interviews Powell's best-selling author Rima Zaman. Tonight's weather, overcast with rain showers tonight, low of 33, light winds, and a chance of rain at about 40%. Tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy skies, high of 48, mostly cloudy skies overnight tomorrow night with a low of 28. Winds will be out of the east-northeast at about 10 to 15 miles per hour. It is International Women's Day, and today in history, in 1702, Queen Anne became the monarch of England. In 1910, Baroness La de la Roche became the first woman to obtain a pilot's license in France. In 1945, Phyllis Mae Daly received a commission in the U.S. Navy Nurse Corps, making her the first African-American nurse to serve in World War II. And in 1975, the first International Women's Day was celebrated. The quote of the day is from Carrie Fisher. I finally quit apologizing for it, for being something different, for being strong. Strength is a style. If you pretend something over and over, sometimes it comes true.
Wednesday morning, City Council sessions start with citizen communication. Anyone can sign up for a 3-minute time slot, and up to 5 citizens are heard each week. Topics this week included recovery from mental health and increasing tar sand oil transport that's coming through Portland. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at City Hall and filed this audio report.
Thank you. First communication, request of Jason Renaud to address council regarding the potential of recovery from mental illness.
I'm Jason Renaud with the Mental Health Association of Portland. Since 2006, the year James Chassie was beaten to death by Portland police officers, the City of Portland has failed to eliminate the routine harm done by police to people with mental illness. Mostly, you failed to understand the solution. Chassie wasn't the first or the last. In 2006, the Portland Police Bureau killed 3 people. In 2007, they killed 2. In 2008, just 1. 2010 made up for 2009 with 5. In 2011, there's 1 person killed by police. In 2012, 2013, 2014 had 2 each. 2015 had 3. 2016 had 1. 2017 had 2. 2018 had 3. That's 27 people over a dozen years. And this is important. Every one of them was in a mental health crisis of some sort. Andre Gladen's death in 2019 was typical. An African-American man with bipolar disorder, clearly ill and in need of compassion and medical services. A homeowner call to 911 brought a police officer who predictably escalated the situation and within moments killed Mr. Gladen. Since 2006, the strategy selected by this council to end the problem was more training. But as it turns out, training, and that was done, more training didn't solve the problem of people getting killed. It's good in its own right, but a basic misunderstanding of the solution. The solution is to uninvolve police officers from people with mental illness in crisis. Separate them, get them as far away from each other as possible. This is a vastly more complicated task than providing training, requiring interdisciplinary cooperation across multiple governments. In the dozen years since James Chassie was killed, the work to reduce contact between police officers and people with mental illness or addiction crisis has not begun. Instead, the council invited the Department of Justice to weld law enforcement to people with mental illness in crisis. This turns out to have been a grievous error. It's the elimination of mental illness and addiction crisis which will reduce the number of persons killed by police. We can stop this, but the work needs to be done before police arrive, not so much after. What this council, as individuals and as a collective voice, can do is to learn and talk about the power and potential of recovery from these illnesses. And recovery is the least expensive and most effective way to reduce use of force by police. I wish Andre Gladden had a chance to recover from his bipolar disorder. It's a complicated illness where a night without sleep or a day without food or a stressful event can cause a crisis. Gladden needed help, not a fight, and he needed it a long time before he was killed by a Portland police officer. Thank you.
That was Jason Renaud of the Mental Health Association of Portland. The city of Portland is operating under fundamental misunderstanding about the interaction between police and folks expressing a mental health crisis. Under this basic error, Portland is not making any progress. In the dozen years since the police killing of James Chassie, the police have killed 27 more people displaying instability. Mr. Renaud calls on City Council to advocate for recovery for mental health as a reality-based solution to police killings. Back to City Hall for more.
Request of Melanie Plott to address Council regarding expansion of oil train infrastructure in Portland Zenith Terminal.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mayor, Commissioners, my name is Melanie Plott. I'm a retired OBGYN physician now working with organizations like 350 PDX to prevent the worst effects of climate change. In November of 2015, the Council adopted the Oil Train Resolution, which is number 37164. To paraphrase only slightly, the last line reads, "It is binding city policy to oppose all projects that would increase the amount of crude oil being transported by rail through the city of Portland." Portland, we have a problem. At the old ARC Logistics site in Northwest Portland, the new owners, Zenith Energy, have converted a prior asphalt terminal into a facility which for the past year has been accepting rail car after rail car of tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, and loading it on ships for export. It gets worse. In the last few months, they've started to expand their infrastructure, enabling them to unload more oil obtained by one of the dirtiest methods of extraction on the planet. This is a triple environmental and justice disaster. First, a disaster for our climate, as you well know. Second, a disaster for the First Nations people of Alberta and the ecological balance of their land. To extract tar sands, trees and topsoil are removed from hundreds of square miles, and the tar sands are scraped up with enormous shovels. Third, it is a disaster for Portland, a true health and safety emergency. I won't go into details, but I refer you to the Multnomah County briefing on oil by rail from 2016. If tar sands oil were to spill into our river, there would be serious trouble. This type of oil is heavy and tends to sink, making cleanup very difficult. A tar sand spill in Kalamazoo, Michigan cost $1 billion and took 5 years to clean up. Clearly, this activity violates the spirit of the laws passed by this body as well as common sense. I urge you to use your authority to put an immediate halt to the expansion of this facility and to the export of tar sands through our city. Our city and this council do not want to be accomplices to this crime. The original permits for this facility and for its expansion were for moving asphalt. Oil trains pose different risks and ought not to be covered under the same permits. There should be an immediate halt to this work until a thorough review can be done.
That was Dr. Melanie Plott of 350 PDX. Zenith Energy is increasing their export of tar sands oil through Portland. This is in violation of their permits and is a threefold disaster: by the environmental havoc caused by burning this fuel, by the ecological disaster caused by the extraction of tar sands oil, and the inherent danger of oil transport through cities. Remember Mosier? Dr. Plout calls on council to immediately halt the illegal transport of tar sands oil through Portland. Those were some citizen communications from Portland City Council last Wednesday, March 6th. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
If you know any children who need dental work their family cannot afford, bring them this Saturday to the Multnomah Dental Society's annual free Children's Health Fair. This event offers various health and dental-related services at no charge. That includes dental, vision, and hearing screenings, dental treatment with mobile dental units right on site, lead poisoning screenings, nutrition and diabetes information, bike safety with free helmets, and Head Start program information as well. The health fair will take place at the Rockwood Boys and Girls Club, located at 454 Southeast 165th Avenue, from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Organizers say they will provide food. Also, every child who goes there will get a goodie bag that includes a toothbrush and toothpaste, as well as information on taking care of their teeth.
A federal report shows that between 2015 and 2018, there were 6,000 reported complaints of sexual abuse from migrant youth shelters nationwide. 170 of these were allegations involving abuse from adult staff, which include reports of inappropriate touching, as well as relationships between minors and adult staff working at the shelter. Morrison Child and Family Services, which has three shelters based in Portland, and can host up to 86 migrant children at one time, has handled 8 of these reports, according to the Offices of Refugee Resettlement and the Department of Justice. A spokesperson from Morrison Child and Family Services stated that they're not permitted to disclose any details about the youth in their facility. They're also not able to give information about the Department of Human Services Office of Training and Investigations and Safety, which decides whether or not to investigate these allegations.
Federal food benefits are going out to everyone who receives them, bringing relief to folks across the country who got last month's assistance early due to the government shutdown. Eric Tagadoff explains how this affects Oregonians.
Were distributed 2 weeks early, meaning more than 600,000 Oregonians who received them needed to stretch those dollars out over 5 or 6 weeks. Don Myers, Oregon's SNAP manager, says families typically run out of benefits around the third week of the month, but that happened sooner during February. Misunderstandings caused other complications as well.
We were hearing stories from some families who had used up their benefits before February even arrived because there were some stories that retailers weren't going to be accepting benefits in February, and so there were some households that were concerned.
About half of SNAP recipients had run out of assistance by February 1st, according to Myers. Benefit delivery is usually staggered over the first 9 days of the month. Myers says food pantries and other community resources picked up the slack when assistance ran out. Susanna Morgan, CEO of Oregon Food Bank, says through a lucky coincidence, pantries had an influx of food in February. The federal government has been purchasing U.S.-grown farm products that were moving through the food bank system to support growers affected by tariffs. Morgan also notes that food pantries fill the SNAP gap throughout the year because SNAP benefits aren't enough to sustain people throughout the month.
Some of these folks would have been folks we would regularly see anyway, just maybe earlier in the month. And some of these folks, this would have been a first time for them to be using food assistance because of that particularly long period of time.
Morgan says food banks and other charitable organizations help fill the gap, but the federal food assistance program does the heavy lifting. For every meal the Oregon Food Bank Network provides, SNAP provides 12. She says too many folks already struggle to feed themselves and their families.
They don't need any more hurdles. They don't need their lives to be made any more difficult than it currently is. And so it's just such a shame that the government shutdown put one more obstacle in the way of these families being successful.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tagadoff.
In a speech given in Geneva earlier this week, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet discussed potential human rights violations by the governments of both China and Israel. Bachelet condemned the presence of widespread forced disappearances in China, particularly in regions populated by China's Uyghur Muslim minority, who have been forcibly detained in remote government re-education camps. Bachelet also denounced Israel's devastating blockade on Gaza, which began in 2007, as a potential human rights violation. In her Wednesday speech, Bachelet said, quote, "Imposing economic hardship on Palestinians does not make Israelis safer," End quote.
Today was the third annual International Women's Strike, bringing attention to working conditions that affect marginalized women from many backgrounds around the world. Over 50 nations participated in this year's strike, calling for a day without women and feminism for the 99%. The group Don't Shoot Portland organized Portland's 2019 strike, which began today at 4 p.m. in Pioneer Courthouse Square and marched to the Salmon Street Springs Fountain. Jane Hocken interviewed organizer and KBOO programmer Alyssa Pariah, about the strike and program before the march.
Yeah, the guiding idea behind the reading is solidarity is our weapon, right? That's what's on all of our flyers, and it's one of our most powerful slogans. And it's true. I mean, that's all we really have. We don't have much else except one another. So we must forge bonds of solidarity with one another. So again, today in Portland, we'll be reporting back from women all over the world. I'm looking at Nigeria, Palestine, India, Sri Lanka, of course, oh my goodness, Brazil and Venezuela, you know, really like with a right-wing boot on their neck, and we're thinking about them every day. I'm from Puerto Rico, right? The colonization continues, the PROMESA Act, slashing public benefits, public spaces, the minimum wage, and again, the colonial relationship continues. So these are the places where their struggle that we want to highlight and make sure that everyone knows about. We're lucky enough to have women leaders in the labor movement now that are able to bring in a class struggle feminism to their locals, their nationals and internationals, and bring this out. And again, to harken back to the teacher strikes of last year and this year, these women are showing us the way. These are working women teachers that are facing budget crises that are imposed on them by really incredible brazen attacks to public education at large.
Today was the third annual women's strike, and that was an excerpt from today's interview by Jan Hocken with Alyssa Pariah. The International Women's Strike aims to build a culture of solidarity amongst all working class women globally, with a call to action for all women to join the fight against gender violence, reproductive rights, and anti-imperialism.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 8th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Natalie Knopf, Emily Gresham-Beamer, Carissa Bohush, and Joe Meyer. The producer is The producer is Tammy Hobteus, and our engineer is Aaron Yankee. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM. And K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 a.m., more talk radio. Host Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey take your calls. At 9, the Ole Mole Variety Hour brings you social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, on Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, they discuss why natural gas is neither natural nor green. Then at 11, Jenna Yokomaya talks with activists fighting to bring attention to the continuing crisis of the Fukushima nuclear plant. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Welcome back to What's Up With Your Down There. I'm your host, Miriam Rosenberg, certified nurse midwife at Legacy Emmanuel Midwifery in Portland, Oregon. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the acid-base balance in your vagina and why it's so important to understanding how to take care down there.
What's up with your down there? What's up with your down there? What's up with your down there? What's up with your down there?
So I'm sitting with my friends in a hot tub when all of a sudden we notice that the water has turned yellow. And not just there's been a lot of people hanging out in this hot tub yellow, but actually more like acidic neon yellow. We do a little bit of internet research. We figure out this can happen to hot tubs sometimes if they get a little bit too acidic. So we go searching around in the garage. We find some chemical whose sole purpose is to make hot tubs more alkaline, dump in a cup of some granules, and voila, the water turns clear. This is amazing to me. Then one of my crew says, so we've been soaking in what apparently